So we're into week three of this series on being an emotionally healthy church. Last week, Heather shared with great vulnerability about living in brokenness and frailty. And she said this, "The goal is to reach our limits and to turn to God on our knees. Find the edges of ourselves so that we are dependent upon him." Find the edges of ourselves so that we are dependent upon him. And today I want to take us a bit deeper on that journey into emotional health. I want to talk about the tears that bring freedom. The tears that bring freedom. Particularly how as individuals and as a church, how we can embrace grieving and loss. I'm going to start with a fairly hard-hitting story from Pete Scazzaro's book, Emotionally Healthy Church, which we're loosely basing this series on. He tells the story of Jerry and Linda Sitzer, who in the autumn of 1991 were traveling with his mother, their four children, ranging from ages 2 to 8, along a highway in a minivan in rural Idaho. They were described as the $2 million family. They had everything. They felt as if they were living on top of the world. And 10 minutes into their drive home, Jerry Sitzer noticed that there was a car traveling very, very fast towards them. So he slowed down on the corner of the road, but this car being driven by a guy who was drunk drove into them at 85 miles an hour. And in one moment, he lost three generations of his family, his mother, his wife, and his four-year-old daughter. He writes, "In one moment, my family as I had known and cherished it was obliterated." He sat on that lonely highway watching them die. The driver of the car was found not guilty because it couldn't be proved beyond doubt that he'd been the driver, because his pregnant wife was killed in the car crash as well. Sitzer then wrote a book on his descent into an abyss of grief and incomprehensible pain. Under the title, A Grace Disguised, How the Soul Grows Through Loss, he writes, "Catastrophic loss, by definition, precludes recovery. It will transform us or destroy us, but it will never leave us the same. There's no going back to the past. It is not, therefore, true that we become less through loss, unless we allow the loss to make us less, grinding our soul down till there's nothing left. Loss can also make us more. Loss can also make us more. I did not get over my loved ones. Rather, I absorbed the loss into my life until it became part of who I am. Sorrow took up permanent residence in my soul and enlarged it. One learns the pain of others by suffering one's own pain, by turning inside oneself, by finding one's own soul. However painful, sorrow is good for the soul. The soul is elastic like a balloon. It can grow larger through suffering." Now, I realize that's a pretty strong statement. It's certainly one that, you know, I don't feel able to make from my own personal experiences, but he's made in his book. And actually, a member of our congregation who was at the earlier service came up to me at the end, and their child died. And he said, "That's exactly what it's like. Your soul can become bigger. It can grow larger through suffering." As I say, I hope I never have to experience anything coming close to the tragedy that Jerry Sitzer experienced. And I hope that none of us here have ever experienced something like that. But I do know that many of us have experienced significant tragedies or difficulties in our lives. So I want to talk about how in emotionally healthy churches, people embrace grief, suffering, and loss in a way that helps them to become more like God. I recognize that this is tough stuff, that many of us will be carrying some level of grief this morning. For some, it will be deeply hidden. For others, it might be quite raw. If you get uncomfortable seeing grown men cry, you may want to look away now, because at the moment, my grief at the decline of my mother's health is very raw. It's near the surface and may emerge even in the next 20 minutes. And if you're not aware, my mum's now suffering from acute leukemia and is in the end of her days here on earth. But I'm not just talking about the grief of bereavement, although quite a lot of what I say today will be about that. But I'm talking here about the grief that comes through any major loss or change, a health loss or health change. Retirement, for some people, can be hugely a time of grief, and for others, can have no impact at all. Moving jobs or home or school, all of these things can lead to a sense of grief or loss. Or even the grief that comes that I see in my mother at the moment, that comes from coming towards the end of one's life and realizing you're not going to see some of the things that you hoped to see in the future. I always say to people who are grieving when I visit them to prepare for a funeral where they've lost a family member, there's no ordinary when it comes to grief. There's no normal. Grief affects us all in different ways in different times. And I want to look at how Jesus showed his grief over Lazarus. Our temperaments, our histories may be different. What may be an insignificant loss for you may be huge for me. Each of us will respond differently. But how did Jesus respond over his friend? I then want to look at how David helps us to process our grief so that our souls can grow larger, so we can become emotionally healthier. We can become more like God. So first of all, Jesus and Lazarus. I'm sure many of you know the story. Some of you may not. It's in John 11. If you've got a Bible, there are Bibles around the church. I encourage you to open it. I'm going to go through it quite quickly, or maybe you've got one on your device. But a quick précis. We've had some of it read to us already. So this man named Lazarus was ill. That's how John 11 starts. His sisters, Martha and Mary, sent word to Jesus, "Lord, the one you love is ill." Okay, Lazarus, Martha, and Mary were really close friends of Jesus. He loved them. He loved them. It says that in the passage. These were his close family friends. It says in verse 5, Jesus loved Martha and her sister and Lazarus. He loved them. So Martha and Mary, when he gets ill, they send message to Jesus. "Jesus, come, your friend Lazarus, our brother, he's ill. You know, you're good at this sort of thing. You heal people. Can you come and sort it out? Can you make him better? Come." And when he heard this, Jesus said, "This illness," to his disciples, "this illness will not end in death. No, it's for God's glory, so that God's Son may be glorified through it." He said that to his disciples. And then he waits 2 days. His friend's ill, very ill. They've sent word, "Come, come." And he waits 2 days. Eventually he goes to Bethany, and it says, as the reading said, as Rachel read to us, Lazarus had been dead at this stage for 4 days. Martha, his sister, comes to Jesus and says, "If you'd been here, he wouldn't have died. If you'd been here, he wouldn't have died." And Jesus says to her this incredible line. This incredible line. "I am the resurrection and the life. The one who believes in me will live even though they die, and whoever lives by believing in me will never die. Do you believe this?" I say that line at every funeral as I'm coming in with a coffin. "I am the resurrection and the life. The one who believes in me will live even though they die. Whoever lives by believing in me will never die." It's an incredible declaration. Jesus, the resurrection and the life. And what does Martha say? She says, "Yes, Lord, I believe you're the Messiah, the Son of God, who's come into the world." Then in verse 32, Mary arrives. She falls at Jesus' feet and said, "Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died." Because she knows that Jesus can make the difference and could have made the difference. And then in verse 33, when Jesus saw her weeping, and the Jews had come along with her also weeping, he was deeply moved in spirit and troubled. "Where have you laid him?" he asked. "Come and see, Lord," they replied. Verse 35, Jesus wept. Then Jesus raises Lazarus from the dead. He calls him out of the tomb. It's an extraordinary, extraordinary story. Here's my question. What is the most extraordinary part of this story? What is the most extraordinary part of this story? It is a man coming back to life, just in case anyone was in doubt. That is absolutely extraordinary. But I think the second, and coming a close second, is verse 35. If you have struggled with memory verses in the Bible, this is a good one to start with. John 11, verse 35, one of the shortest verses in the Bible. Jesus wept. Jesus wept. What on earth is going on? Why is Jesus crying? Has he forgotten what he said to the disciples earlier? This illness will not end in death. No, it's for the God's glory, so that God's Son may be glorified through it. Is he weeping? Does he suddenly go, oh, hang on, I've remembered, I'm the Son of God, I can sort this out. Miracle time! Was that what's going on? No, of course not. But he knew he was going to heal Lazarus. He knew they were about to see God glorified. He said that was going to take place. So why is he crying? He wept, it says, because he was deeply moved. And the Greek word underlying deeply moved means to feel something strongly, angrily even. One of the commentators says the word can refer to the snorting of a horse when it's angry. So there's an anger thing going on here. He's angry about what he sees. He's deeply moved. Tim Keller, the pastor in New York, writes this. As he was about to raise Lazarus from the dead, Jesus was not smiling. He was angry. He was weeping. Why? Because death is a bad thing. Jesus wasn't thinking, they think this is a tragedy, but no harm done. I'm about to raise him from the dead. This looks like a bad thing, but it's not. It's really a good thing. It's a way for me to show my glory. It's really exciting. I can't wait. He wasn't thinking that. Jesus was weeping at the tomb because the bad thing he's about to work for good is bad. The story of Lazarus does not give you a saccharine, that means a sweet view of suffering, saying bad things are really blessings in disguise or that every cloud has a silver lining. The Bible never says anything like that. God will give bad things good effects in your life, but they're still bad. Jesus Christ's anger at the tomb of Lazarus proves that he hates death. He also hates loneliness, alienation, pain, and suffering. Jesus hates it all so much that he was willing to come into this world and experience it all himself so that eventually he could destroy it without destroying us. He was not afraid to weep, to show his anger, to show his sadness at the distress his friends were feeling. When was the last time you had a good cry? When was the last time you had a good cry? You see, I don't think as a nation we're very good at grief. I don't think we know how to handle it. I don't think we know how to handle grief in others. We all get a bit embarrassed when we see someone crying, or we feel stiff upper lip and all that. We're British, or we apologise if we're crying. You know, I visit families and they're grieving. And they might start crying for that lost loved one. And they start apologizing for crying. I think, why are you apologizing? There's nothing to apologize for here. But I think it comes from, right, I think tears are rejected at an early age in our society. Early age. And, you know, I don't know if you ever had that playground experience when maybe you were getting a little bit angry, a little bit upset, and someone would go, are you going to cry? And that was the worst thing that could happen because you didn't want to cry and they were saying you're going to cry and then everyone's going to call you a crybaby. Or was that just me? Anyone else? Oh, okay, we won't go there. And we say, you know, you hear things like real men don't cry. Real men don't cry. Nonsense. Nonsense. Real men do cry. Jesus was the most real man who ever walked this earth. He went through the most courageous self-sacrifice on the cross for you and me, choosing physical, spiritual, and emotional pain. He is the one who we are to become like, and he models tears. He models tears. As I get older, I want to cry more because I've discovered that tears release something. Tears can bring healing. I remember in our old church in London, a friend joined us who didn't know Jesus, and every week as we started worshipping, she started crying. She didn't know why. She said, I don't understand it. I just start crying. And I says, great. You're discovering the healing power of God as his spirit meets with your spirit. And she found worship an incredibly healing experience, and she now leads worship in a local church. I want to weep at the pain of the world. I want to weep for my pain. I want to weep for my friend's pain. I want to weep for the pain of the world. How do we process our pain and the pain of the world? How do we get angry about it but not let it overwhelm us? How do we become more like God in our grief rather than reject him? The first thing we do is recognize and embrace it. Jesus didn't get straight on to healing Lazarus. He allowed himself time to weep. He didn't have to. He knew the outcome. He could have just walked straight up to the grave and go, "Out you come, Lazarus. It's time." He didn't need to weep. He chose to weep. And sometimes we're so quick to want to fix things that we miss what God wants to do in the broken place. I'm a great fixer. I want to fix things. And if I see tears, I want to fix them. But paying attention is part of the grief process. Paying attention to our emotions and perhaps even asking the question when our emotions are all a bit awry, am I grieving over something right now? A broken relationship, a past bereavement, a job change, a loss. Am I grieving? Another extraordinary hero of the Bible was King David. Extraordinary warrior. Incredibly brave, taking on bears and lions as a young shepherd in preparation for his victory over the giant Goliath. Then he led Israel's armies into many battles. However, he was never afraid to grieve. Never afraid to express his emotions. In the Psalms, which he wrote many of the Psalms, you read him in Psalm 18 calling out, "In my distress, I called to the Lord. I cried to my God for help. From his temple, he heard my voice. My cry came before him into his ears." David has a response to grief and loss, which is a great model for us to follow. I want to suggest that there's three distinct phases we need to go through. The first is we need to pay attention to pain. David is seen in the Bible as a man after God's heart, and he teaches his people to lament. He teaches them to grieve. When David heard of Saul and Jonathan's death, Saul had been his enemy, although he'd been very loyal to him. The king who was before him, who he was now going to take the throne of, Jonathan had been his best friend. When he heard of their death, he didn't immediately think, okay, let's move on to the next step in God's plan where I become the king of Israel. No, instead he grieved. He couldn't bear to think of the Philistines rejoicing. So he writes a song, a poem, a moving, beautiful, detailed lament of the horror that has occurred. "Your glory, O Israel, lies slain on your heights. How the mighty have fallen. Saul and Jonathan, in life they were loved and gracious." He anguishes over the catastrophe three times. "How the mighty have fallen." Consumed with grief, he addresses Jonathan directly. "I grieve for you, Jonathan, my brother." You can read that poem in 2 Samuel 1. And at the start of the poem, it says, David took up this lament concerning Saul and his son Jonathan, and he ordered that the people of Judah be taught this lament of the bow. He ordered the people of Israel that they learn how to grieve. He didn't just rush on to the next thing. So if you need to grieve, or if you're in a place where you're finding it difficult to grieve, or you know life is a struggle, the Psalms are a great place to go. And the majority of the Psalms are far from cheerful. More than half of the 150 are classified as laments. Laments. Most, as I said, were according to tradition, were written by David. They pay attention to the reality that life can be hard, difficult, sometimes even brutal. They take notice of the apparent absence of God. They notice when circumstances seem to say that God is not good. They cry out to God for comfort and care. The model and teaching is for us to deal honestly and prayerfully with our losses and our disappointments, big and small, and all their accompanying confusing emotions. So first, we embrace. Second, we wait in the confusing in-between. The confusing in-between. The theology professor, Walter Brueggemann, has said the Psalms can be divided into three types. Orientation, disorientation, reorientation. So the first are songs of orientation, where we enjoy God, his creation, his blessings, delight in his goodness, and enjoy a rich sense of well-being and joy in him. The second are songs of disorientation, seasons of hurt, suffering, and dislocation, written when the bottom falls out and we wonder what is happening. This is the confusing in-between, when we so often feel doubts, resentment, isolation, and despair. And sometimes we rebel during the confusing in-between periods, rather than embrace the waiting period in which we find ourselves. The temptation to flee from God, to quit, or to fall into despair is great when it appears God is absent. But this is a time to say to our friends, I'm in the place of in-between. Will you walk with me? Will you sit with me? Will you cry with me? It's not the time to head off on our own. It's the time to push into community, not push away from it. It's the time to be honest about what you're thinking and feeling. And then the third are the Psalms of reorientation, when God breaks in and does something new. This is when joy breaks through our despair. Because if we can keep waiting in the in-between time, then eventually, it may be a long time, but eventually, God breaks in and does something new. Joy breaks through despair. And phase three is allowing the old to birth the new. As a result of grieving, we experience new inner births or changes. We have a greater capacity to wait on God and surrender to his will. Grieving breaks something in our fearful self-will, in the bit of us that says, I need to be in control of the universe, my universe and God's universe. It breaks something and allows us to return to God. We become kinder and more compassionate. Sadness softens our defense and people find us safer. Henri Nouwen says that the degree to which we grieve our losses is the degree to which we're compassionate. He writes this, there is no compassion without many tears. To become like the Father whose only authority is compassion, I have to shed countless tears and so prepare my heart to receive anyone, whatever their journey has been, and forgive them from the heart. Recognizing our own pain, we are able to enter the pain of others. And ultimately, this results in us becoming more at home with ourselves and with God. So back to Jesus and Lazarus. He wept at the loss of his friend, at the pain of his friends. He was angry at death. He restored Lazarus to life. Jesus understands our suffering and our grief, our loss. In Hebrews 5, it says, during the days of Jesus' life on earth, he offered up prayers and petitions with fervent cries and tears to the one who could save him from death. And he was heard because of his reverent submission. Son though he was, he learned obedience from what he suffered. And once made perfect, he became the source of eternal salvation for all who obey him. Whatever is going on in your life right now, God is big enough to hold you. So last Tuesday was Mum's 87th birthday. I went and had lunch with her, with my dad, and with my sister. We laughed together. We wept together. She prayed for us, and she said some things that I can't even speak. Someone asked me a few weeks ago, was I ready for her death? I replied yes and no. I know it's going to happen. I know as a family it's going to be very painful because she means so much to us. I don't know how grief is going to affect me, But what I'm learning is that I'm not going to hide the grief. I'm not going to hide it from you, my church family. I'm not going to put on a brave face or hide my emotions. I'm not going to apologize for my tears, but rather I'm going to embrace grief and take all of my emotions to God and ask him to continue to transform my life so that I might grieve with those who grieve, confident that ultimately joy will break through any despair. Let us laugh together and let us weep together as we seek to become more healthy together. Lord Jesus, thank you that you are here in this place by your Spirit. Thank you that you know everything about every one of us. You know the disappointments of the past, the bereavements of the past, the hurts of the past, the losses of the past. You know it all. But we hide it from you and we hide it from each other. Lord, would you come into those places that we're scared to open up to one another? And would you, in our places of loss and grief, help us to embrace those things? Help us to wait in the confusing in-between places. Help us to know that you can hold us, whatever it is we're going through. Help us to be more aware of your presence with us now. And come and meet with us by your Spirit.